from the University of Leicester in the United Kingdom. This is Glenn Fulcher with the very first issue of Language Testing Bites. In this first Language Testing Bites podcast, we're very lucky to welcome Professor Mike Kane. As many of you will know, Professor Kane recently moved to Educational Testing Service to take up the Messick Chair in Test Validity. He's a prolific author on this topic and wrote the influential chapter on validation in the fourth edition of Educational Measurement. He's taught at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, the State University of New York at Stony Brook, and the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Prior to moving to ETS, he was Director of Test Development at the National League for Nursing, Vice President for Research and Development at ACT, and Research Director at the National Council of Bar Examiners.
Mike, welcome to Language Testing Bites. It's a pleasure to have you talk to us on this very first issue of the podcast.
Well, nice to be with you.
Great. Your approach to validation is widely quoted in the language testing literature, and in combination with evidence-centered design, it formed the basis for the revision of the test of English as a foreign language. Now, in my reading of your work, it seems to me that the notion of the interpretive argument is central to your approach. Can you tell us what an interpretive argument is, and perhaps give us an example?
Okay. Many of my views, like everybody else, come from my experiences, and I've spent a lot of my working life in different applied settings. I worked in, my first job was in placement and running a placement and proficiency testing program at the University of Illinois, and then subsequently I was director of test development at the National League for Nursing, and then I worked at ACT on a variety of things. So I've worked in a lot of applied settings, and it seemed to me that the way to in looking at validity more theoretically as the appropriateness of interpretations and uses, that one of the differences between these different settings is kind of the interpretations we used and the kinds of uses that we were putting the test to.
Mm-hmm.
So it seemed important to me that we should be clear about what the proposed interpretation and use were and what the implications of those were before we launched into analyzing the validity of these interpretations and uses. And so I put forward the interpretive argument as a way of specifying the proposed interpretation and use in some detail and explicitly. And I don't know that an argument is the only way to do it. I think in some context, construct language helps, and in some cases, content specifications are really important.
Mm-hmm.
But to sort of make it general, it seemed to me that the notion of argument was a good one.
Mm-hmm.
So, and one area in which this came up was in licensure and certification testing. There's a tendency for people to want to show that the tests predict performance. And that really doesn't work very well, because when somebody gets licensed as a doctor or a nurse, they go off and they work in lots of different settings. The people who fail the test don't get to practice.
Mm.
And the criteria for evaluating how well somebody's doing are kind of vague. So it's really hard to do predictive validity. But on the other hand, it seems that licensure and certification serves a really useful purpose in establishing that somebody is well enough qualified to be allowed out into practice at a specific point in time. So one of the places where this came up for me was that in the interpretation and use of licensure and certification exams, you don't have to include a notion of predicting performance in the future. The argument works quite well if you say that we're going to evaluate somebody's competence in a domain of knowledge, skills, and judgment at a particular point in time. And if they meet certain standards, we'll give them this piece of paper that they can hang on the wall and they can practice. And if they don't meet those standards, then we consider them to be not well enough prepared to be let loose on the public. And prediction never comes into it. validation too difficult by not specifying clearly what the intended interpretation was in licensure and certification. And in some other cases, we weren't being hard enough because there were all sorts of inferences being made on the basis of the test scores that weren't addressed in the validation study. Mm. So my intent was to sort of, and my basic concern was to find a general method for specifying the proposed interpretation and use to put it on the table for evaluation. So that was the general idea.
Right. In your explanation there, it seems pretty clear when you're referring to the argument that you kind of draw on the work of Toulmin. And I've kind of always been struck by the similarity between Toulmin's notion of substantial argument and Dewey's concept of warranted assertion. Both seem to require that we provide reasons or warrants and evidence to support the claims we make, but also postulate that any conclusions we reach are contingent upon future research that challenges the interpretive argument. Do you see your work as drawing on these insights, or as an evolution of this pragmatic approach to inferencing?
Well, I think historically it doesn't, because I wasn't really very familiar with that work. I've read a little bit of Dewey, and I always found him very insightful, but he didn't really have a big impact in forming my ideas. I, as an undergraduate, and early in my graduate career, I was a physics student, so I came more out of the philosophy of science, people like Popper, Kuhn, and particularly Lakatos. And my advisor in graduate school was Patrick Soupies, who is a logician and philosopher of science. So I came that way, but I also recognize that sort of the strict logical, mathematical kinds of models that people use in these contexts in many cases and that are seen as being particularly desirable didn't really work for testing programs in applied settings, that they were much messier and context-dependent. And one of the things I liked about Toulmin is that he sort of, his treatment of argumentation is very general and flexible. And he allows for the fact that the criteria that you use for warranted assertions might vary from one context to another. That is the kinds of evidence that you would expect to be able to get and use in one context might be different from that in another. I do think, though, I'd like to learn more about Dewey and the pragmatist, but I haven't done that in the past. So,
Right. Well, moving on from that and the interpretive argument, I mean, some of our listeners may be more familiar with the term validity argument, which is used a lot in language testing, than interpretive argument. And in your approach to validation, you use both. So could you explain briefly what the relationship is between an interpretive argument and a validity argument?
Okay, I see the interpretive argument as sort of stating the proposed interpretation in use, of sort of putting it on the table for discussion, evaluation, criticism. I then see the validity argument as producing an evaluation of that interpretive argument, of whether the test and the context and the inferences being made actually fit together in a way that makes sense, is defensible, and to use that favorite word, or warranted by the available evidence. The I sort of see that I think of the interpretive argument as being the one little thing that I added to this enterprise in terms of terminology, in that I was looking for some way of describing this system for specifying what's being claimed so that it could then be evaluated in the validity argument. And I think the validity argument, notion I sort of got from Kronbach's 1988 paper and from House's work on program evaluation. I think, by the way, that as an interesting aside, that Kronbach's views on validity fit in with his notions of program evaluation, in part because program evaluations are intrinsically messy and context-dependent. You know, it's actually some program is out there in the world and is trying to achieve something. It has some consequences, and there are a lot of assumptions being made and outcomes that can be hard to measure and quantify. So it's not a neat mathematical logical system, which we tend to like in measurement theory. We like sort of nice mathematical models. And I think Kronbach and House sort of those aspects of program evaluation come into their notions of validity, and I've sort of bought into that to a large extent. I like that aspect of their work.
Well, I'd just like to follow up on that and your definitions by asking about the place of constructs in your approach, which follows on rather nicely there. I recently read a 2010 paper by Carol Chappelle and colleagues in Educational Measurement Issues and Practice, entitled "Does an Argument-Based Approach to Validity Make a Difference?" And they say that they found the approach that you've just described to be a very practical and pragmatic approach to structuring a test design project, one in which they couldn't clearly define a construct and operationalize that construct. Now, what they say, and I'm going to quote this to you, is Kane's organizing concept of an interpretive argument which does not rely on a construct proved to be useful. Now, do you think that we can bypass construct definition in the way that they imply is possible?
I think we can. One of the problems, I'm not really crazy about construct language, mainly because construct now in our literature has so many different meanings. And unless you specify what you mean by a construct at the beginning of an article, nobody would know what you were talking about. If you discussed constructs. In the original version in Kronbach and Meehl, a construct is a theoretical entity embedded in a sort of mathematical or at least a formal theory, and the construct is implicitly defined by the theory, something like, you know, entropy in thermodynamics or something else. Now, we don't have constructs like that. We don't have theories like that in lots of areas in which we work. In a few, we might have something to approximate it. That notion sort of was associated with the logical positivist to some extent, and is less probably central to philosophy of science now. So then constructs became sort of general ideas of what we're talking about, and were defined in terms of any connection with anything. So you get these statements in the literature where any connection between your variable and any other variable is grist for the mill in validity, and it makes it really difficult to know what to do. You know, if there are an infinite number of possible things you could look at and no criteria for saying which one you should do first, you tend to grind to a halt. So I think construct language helps in some areas. Like, I think if you're talking about lots of psychological attributes, personality characteristics like aggressiveness and so on, construct language makes sense, and you can do something that sort of approximates Kronbach and Meehl to some extent. And that was the area in which Kronbach and Meehl introduced the concept to deal with. I mean, they explicitly said that they introduced construct validity to deal with measures of attributes like aggressiveness or intuitive ability or something that couldn't be defined in terms of content domains and couldn't be defined in terms of predicting some criterion. So in some areas I think it works. In some areas I think defining content domains makes sense. And all of those can be subsumed under the general notion of an interpretive argument. So I prefer not to focus so much on construct language, mainly because I think it has so many meanings that it's meaningless now.
I was going to say that from there, I mean, it falls on nicely to the issue of content, which has recently come back into the fray, as it were. So if I could just turn to this recent controversy, I mean, in 2007, Lissitz and Samuelson published this paper in Educational Researcher, in which they argued that the whole of the validity should be about content, which is, I guess, is a move away from construct languages as well. And together with reliability, they kind of argue that it should be, that these should be classified as concerns that are internal to the test. As I understand it, in this conception, everything else that we would think of as Messick's aspects of validity would essentially be excluded from validity. Now, I know that you've responded to this in a number of papers already, but could you tell us why you find the Lissitz definition of validity to be problematic?
Okay, I think on purely logical grounds, I would say it's not necessarily problematic. You can define validity any way you want, right? I mean, we can define a term. We can stipulate that a term means X, Y, or Z. So in a particular context, if you wanted to define it in terms of content-based evidence and reliability, that would be okay. And I've talked about what I call observable attributes that are sort of defined that way as one category. But I think there are lots of things that we measure that go far beyond that. They make assumptions about underlying traits. They make assumptions about what's going to happen with relationships to other variables, predictions of future performance, consequences, etc. And so the meanings that we assign to our test scores often go far beyond content. And I think if you restrict validity to just content, what tends to happen is a sort of version of begging the question. You know, we define validity in terms of a very restricted definition, content and reliability. And then we make all these other inferences and we say, well, we have a valid test, so those inferences are going to be okay implicitly. And I think that doesn't work. Basically, I think that the other thing that Samuelson and Lissitz say is that, well, these things like consequences and fairness and so on will be dealt with elsewhere. And then my question is, well, where?
Yeah.
You know, who's going to do it if we don't do it? The local user doesn't have the resources to address these issues. Politicians typically are not interested in addressing them. Often they don't want to address them because they might find out something that would be inconvenient. So if we in measurement don't address them, who is going to do it and when?
Yeah.
And my sense is that never. So pushing, the other thing, I guess one other thing I'd say is that I think validity has evolved to be broader than the definition by Lissitz and Samuelson. And if we want to go back to that, we probably need to rewrite a lot of our textbooks and other things, because we have statements saying validity is the most important characteristic of testing programs. And if it's only content, then I would say in some cases it's not the most important context, the most important issue. It's, you know, in some issues, like in a placement test, the consequences, whether you put the person in the right course, is really the central issue. It's not the content of the test per se.
Well, so, on that note, you're moving outside of that, and I come to your contribution to issue 27.2 of language testing, which was a response to a paper on the topic of how we can define and achieve fairness in testing, and I guess this would be fairly, it would be, you know, well outside of the definition of validity that Lissitz is arguing for. He would definitely put uses and consequences outside of validity. So what place do you think fairness and consequences have within your approach to validity?
Well, I tend to think that consequences have really been a part of our notion of validity for a long time, especially in placement selection tests, et cetera. So that consequences are not necessarily new. What is a bit new is social consequences, which got pushed. Again, I think that was implicit way back, but Messick made it explicit and pushed it very hard in a number of articles and sort of brought it to the foreground. But I think that we should take responsibility for the consequences of our testing programs. And one of the basic rules, as I understand it, for physicians in their oath is that they should do no harm. And I think in testing, it's hard to be able to guarantee that you're going to do no harm, because if you assign somebody to a particular program, sometimes you're going to make the wrong decision. And if you hire one person and not another, there's always a trade-off there and somebody has lost. But I think that we have an obligation, like everybody else in every area, to think about the consequences of what we're doing. Yeah. And try not to have larger negative consequences as well as having sort of immediate positive consequences in what we do. So I think consequences need to be thought about, and we should think about them. Whether you want to include that in validity or as something else is a debatable question, but it seems to me a natural place to put it, or at least to have it. It could be in other places as well. But it's a natural place to have it, because consequences for individuals and for employers in terms of, or educational institutions in terms of selection and placement, have been an integral part of validity for 100 years. Hmm. And so adding the larger social consequences seemed to me not to be a tremendously big leap. Now, the difficulty with dealing with consequences is that it pulls us out of the, there are a lot of trade-offs and social and even political concerns in dealing with consequences, and it's a messy, sort of difficult question. Hmm. And it pulls us away from nice mathematical models, but I don't think that's a bad thing.
Hmm. And as you say, it's a debate that is going to go on for some time, not only in the pages of language testing, but conferences and hopefully beyond. And this will, I hope, will contribute to that. But I'm afraid, Mike, on that note, it's all we have time for in this podcast. So I'd like to thank you for this interesting conversation and for giving all the readers of language testing such a great insight into your approach to validation.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Thank you for listening to this issue of Language Testing Bites. Language Testing Bites is a production of the journal Language Testing from Sage Publications. You can subscribe to Language Testing Bites through iTunes, or you can download future issues from ltj.sagepub.com or from languagetesting.info. So, until next time, we hope you enjoy the current issue of Language Testing.